Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
I was always a dreamer. I always saw a life beyond the life that I had as a child.
It was like a big flashing light. This is what you're supposed to do.
Everybody poo-pooed the idea. Network said it couldn't be done.
You're in that zone, and it's that out-of-body experience where it just, everything clicks.
Sometimes you have those dark moments. I was so depressed when I got fired.
I was so mad.
People don't need to be afraid to fail. And again, that's where you learn. You shouldn't be afraid of adversity. You know, that is the thing that makes you strong.
This is Jerry Levias.
This is Jody Markell.
This is Chi Young.
This is Dick Vitale, and you're listening to American Achievers.
Welcome to American Achievers, the podcast that celebrates ambition, commitment to excellence, risk-taking, and tenacity on the road to success. I'm Keith Dunovant. Some of my guests are world-famous. Some are rather obscure. Our weekly lineup includes entrepreneurs, athletes, military heroes, civic leaders, artists, and media figures. What they all have in common is a sense of undeniable purpose and an intriguing story that reflects the power of the American dream. We live in a world where Saturday leads inevitably to Sunday, or so it seems. In reality, relatively few major college football players ultimately make it in the NFL. The odds are very long. But the dream, oh, the dream lives inside them all, burns, pulsates, motivates. The tantalizing thought of someday playing on Sunday underpins the whole system. Juiced by contentious recruiting battles, lucrative NIL deals, and the increasingly disruptive transfer portal. But this week's guest came of age in a very different world. Growing up in Southern California, Randy Cross never really thought about playing in the NFL. Performing at a high level at UCLA eventually pushed him toward his future, but it was not a fire that raged inside his belly. Being drafted by the San Francisco 49ers placed him in an elite crowd, but in those early years, he wasn't very serious about his chosen profession. Ambition can take time. By the time Bill Walsh showed up, Randy's attitude had started to change. As Walsh built a dynasty around the innovative West Coast offense, Cross matured into one of the best, most versatile offensive linemen of the 1980s. Then he managed a transition that eludes many successful athletes. Leveraging three Super Bowl rings and a studious, analytical nature, Cross glided into a long career in television, including many years as a football analyst for CBS Sports. Randy, your father fought in World War II, including the very bloody Battle of Guadalcanal. Did he talk about the war with you?
Not a whole lot, which didn't make him unusual, that's for sure. At least from what I always understood from friends whose dads were also involved in that kind of stuff. Towards the end of his life, maybe a little bit more, but not too expansive on the explanations and the experiences. He was with the first Marines, and he used to go to a reunion every year down in Long Beach in the San Pedro area. And I always wanted to go with him. And, you know, he said there was nothing there that would be that good. It's just him and a bunch of guys that he served with, blah, 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 blah. But he shared a few stories. And it was usually some stuff born out of, I would say, kind of in a complaint on my side. You know, I made a comment once where I said, sometimes when you're working and things aren't going great, but you're still working and working, you're kind of by yourself, it seems kind of lonely. And he looked at me, got this funny look on his face, and he says, lonely. He says, try getting dropped off on a Pacific island with a bunch of guys. And the next morning you wake up, you look out to sea, and all those ships that dropped you off are all gone. He goes, that's lonely. Okay.
That's some perspective right there.
Yeah.
You think he was haunted by the war?
To a degree, yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think it's something that, you know, you go through his life and sort of his experiences. He had to be pretty affected by that whole experience. You know, he had a whole laundry list of stuff, but you know, I just think that was that whole generation kind of put their life on hold and their futures on hold for our country, which, you know, I think people, thankfully, as time went on, became more and more aware of and more appreciative of.
Is that something that you thought about it one way when you were a kid and you think about it differently today?
Yeah, I think so. I was in a kind of a different generation. I was my last year, I think my senior year in high school, was the last draft, either the last draft or next to last draft. And I was like, my number, you know, I used to do that lottery. My number was like 360. But that was still, Vietnam was going hot and heavy in 71, 72. So yeah, I think it was something in the back of your mind all the time, especially when there's some sort of an active war going on. And, you know, there was always that possibility, no matter, you know, what it was you did, that you're going to get drafted and you're going to have to go.
Well, of course, your father became an actor and a successful actor. And you guys, when you were a little fella, moved to Los Angeles. What are your earliest memories of him being an actor?
You know, not too much, as far as we never really got to go early on, at least, and see him work. That wasn't kind of how that worked. But my main, you know, my impression of acting, actors waited around the house waiting for the phone to ring. That to me was what being an actor was. I didn't have the appreciation of the craft or anything else. But in order to get work, the phone had to ring. And in order for my dad to get work and do something, they had to call him. He gets a job and he went to go. Or he'd go to an audition, he'd get the job. And, you know, our first question we always asked him when he said he got a job was, do you die? And, you know, most of the time he did. He was a character actor. That's what happened to character actors. But, no, it was something. It gave me a appreciation of something I really didn't want much part of. I did a little bit of it as a kid, just, you know, reading parts and going to auditions and things like that. But, yeah, it never was anything that appealed to me very much.
And yet he was in a pretty big show called The Blue Angels, which must have been really cool.
Yeah, it was. It was really cool. You know, he's being a former Marine, there was that connection to the Navy, and to see your dad on TV and he was the star, and, you know, it was very, very proud. You know, up to that point, he'd always been in something, you know, whether it was Wanted Dead or Alive or The Rifleman or Big Valley, or you can go down that list, you know, and he was in that stuff and it was fun. He was in movies and that was fun, but to have him on the TV every single week, in a part that, you know, heck, he was basically the lead guy. So he was in all the stuff. It was, it made me appreciate how hard he worked and sort of the reward it was.
Now, did you ever see him die on TV? Like from at the hands of Chuck Connors or someone like that?
Oh yeah. Oh, heck yeah.
Was that traumatizing as a kid?
All the time. I mean, there was an episode of Rifleman, and there was a guy from Argentina who was like a hitman, and he, you know what what bolos are?
Sure.
Right at the beginning of the story, My dad's out there and he's the bad guy and he's trying to get this other guy. And well, the guy kills him with bolos. And it's like, what the hell? How do you die? The least they could do is shoot you, Dad. Come on. They got you with a stick with some hard balls on. What's the deal with that? But yeah, that was pretty standard procedure watching him. So he died at Get Smart. Nobody died at Get Smart. But wow. My dad had Maxwell Smart's shoe gun went off and it was about 5 ricochets and it killed my dad.
Wow. Did he even get to kiss Agent 99 or something? I mean, you know.
No, not really. Not really. I think he was actually holding a gun on him at the time.
What's the most important lesson you learned from your dad?
Resilience, persistence. You know, he had some personal demons and he worked through that. And anybody that's had a parent that has alcohol or drug problems through the course of your life. I mean, I didn't really get to know my dad per se. I mean, to actually know my dad until probably my freshman year in college. Right around then, because that's when he quit drinking and he was sober for, you know, a good 20 years or so after that.
How did that mark you at that point?
Well, it does. You know, anybody that tells you it doesn't, I think, is either have selective amnesia or is lying. It was pretty traumatic in a lot of ways. It gives you a very warped opinion on drunks and drinking. But it didn't prevent me from being the usual teenage idiot and early college idiot and all that other stuff. But that always kind of lurked in the back of my mind because, you know, as it turned out, I had five sisters and a brother. So there were 7 of us, the siblings. And, you know, between my dad and a few of my sisters and brother, you know, they had some issues too. So you might say that whole deal didn't run in our family. It kind of sprinted. Mm.
And what was your ambition as a little boy?
I was a big baseball player. I was a huge Dodger fan, which, you know, being born in Brooklyn and raised in LA, who could have guessed that? But, you know, I was a big fan of Sandy Koufax and Don Drysdale and, you know, Maury Wills and all those great, John Roseborough, all those great teams back in LA. I wanted to play baseball. And it wasn't until, you know, heck, I got to high school in the 9th grade and they had the ingenious idea in my high school at that time, the baseball coach, that the first week, all you did was run because he needed less guys to be on the team. He had more people than he had spots on the team. So he figured he'd run them all to death and get them to quit. So that's sort of what brought about my career throwing the shot put was the fact that baseball wasn't available, but you know, sports and professional sports, I didn't think about that at all. And honestly didn't think about that at all until probably the spring of my junior year at UCLA. When Gil Brandt from the Dallas Cowboys told me I was going to get drafted in the first or second round, and I had no idea, to be honest. My coaches had said you could do it for a career, but, you know, sports wasn't something that even registered in my mind of doing for a career.
Well, and you played for, you know, two great coaches, Pepper Rodgers and Terry Donahue. Very different guys.
Yeah, very different. Pepper was, you know, for lack of a better term, you know, he was that 1970s, you know, double knit suit, big wide lapels, you know, sell ice chests to the folks living up in the Arctic Circle, sell ice to them. I mean, he could do anything. He was always on TV. He was very loud, very strong personality. Terry Donahue was my line coach all 4 years. Very, very quiet, very composed kind of a guy. Had a huge impact on my football career. But the real contrast was between Pepper Rodgers and Dick Vermeil, who were my two head coaches at UCLA. Because when Dick got there my junior year, it was a stark contrast to Pepper. Dick was serious, very, very serious. They were in your life for your life, not just for the 4 years you were in college. My mom and dad used to get Christmas cards from Dick and Carol Vermeil every year until the day they died. They are special people. And Dick was that kind of a guy. So, you know, I imagine you ask a guy like Vince Papale that the movie was about, he'd tell you the exact same thing. Dick cared about the people that played for him.
And you ended up doing something which was really unusual, playing both center and guard and you know, becoming an All-American at that point. Talk to me about, you know, that was a heck of a transition. And at times you had to go back and forth, which is very unusual.
Yeah, my freshman year, I played basically offensive guard and defensive tackle, but mainly defense on the freshman team. And then that spring, Terry Donahue told me I was going to learn how to snap and play center. So I played center my sophomore year, traded time with Art Kuhn, who would later go on and play for the Seahawks for a long time. Then my junior year, I moved over. Art was a full-time center, and I was the right guard. And then my senior year, we had legitimately 9 or 10 really good linemen. So in a unique move, we had two offensive lines. We had the first offensive line, and I was the right guard on that. And we'd play the first two or three series, and then we'd just change over in the next line and come in for two or three series. And I was a center on that group. So it was I was the only one that didn't leave the field. But, yeah, I think it might have sent the right message maybe at the next level that I had some versatility. And versatility can at times be kind of a curse. Because, you know, I would later make a Miller Lite commercial after my retirement from the NFL. And in that commercial, I was referred to as an all-pro center, though I had never made all-pro at center. I'd been second team and all-NFC and stuff like that. But, yeah, that was labeling. Because most of the people that remember me playing football don't remember that of the 13 years, I played 9.5 at guard and 3.5 at center.
So you get to the 49ers, you're drafted, what, in the second round? And obviously this has got to be every kid's dream. You're playing in the National Football League, and you're playing on a pretty awful football team to start out with.
Yeah. I mean, even then, though, I wasn't thinking about playing a bunch of pro football. I had actually done an interview, as all, you know, rookies do, and after you get drafted. And I made a comment that I wasn't sure how long I wanted to play football, but I'd know when it was time to stop playing football and I'd get on with my real life. And Monty Clark, who was an offensive line coach for those great Dolphin teams in the 70s, early 70s, was my head coach. And I didn't know he was standing behind me. That this board had all the articles up and the highlighted quotes. And I'm reading this quote. All of a sudden, this voice behind me says, "Your career might be a lot shorter than you think if you don't get your ass out there." Okay.
And then after about 3 years, a guy named Bill Walsh shows up. He's had some success as the head coach at Stanford, but honestly, mm-hmm. in the NFL, he was a fairly unknown name. And when he arrives, everything changes.
Yeah, well, not immediately, though. I mean, my first 3 years, we had won 8 games, 5 games, and 2 games. And I was going into my fourth year in 79, and Bill Walsh was my fifth head coach. So we'd had a little change. we hadn't won many. And in 79, his first year, we also won 2 games. We went 2-14. And then we won 6-10 in 80. So that turnaround that, you know, at times was sort of the perception was it was so quick. man, those 2 years of not winning much didn't feel like it was too fast. But when it did start happening, it happened pretty good.
Well, of course, the game that everybody remembers, 1981, the NFC Championship game against Dallas. Dallas was the 800-pound gorilla, had been in the NFC since the late 60s. Put me on the field for the climactic fourth quarter for that game. What do you remember?
Probably the nuttiest thing that I remember, mainly by virtue of looking at the box score, was all the penalties and turnovers. I mean, it was crazy. We had fumbles and interceptions, and they had fumbles, and the amount of penalties and turnovers and everything else. It came to that last drive. I had kind of a stomach flu. I'd come down with that morning, so we're going out there for that last drive. I was concentrating on trying to keep my water down more than anything else. I'd love to have been nervous, but I wasn't feeling real good, so I was trying to concentrate on that aspect. But that is the most memorable thing about it, was the result. But it was not pretty. I mean, it wasn't even close to pretty. It was actually a pretty doggone ugly, you know, famous game.
And, of course, that's the game when the country, or at least those people in the country who hadn't been paying attention, kind of discovered a guy named Joe Montana.
Yeah, and that guy that caught the ball, Dwight Clark.
Did you actually see that? Were you vertical when he caught the ball?
I was vertical. I was looking right down that side of the field, that sideline, because my guy was one of the guys that was chasing Joe. The play was sprint right option, and it's designed to be thrown basically over the tight end, you know, behind the tight end. But he had run and run, and they'd adjusted their routes, and he threw that thing, and it looked like Dwight had a stepladder. He jumped so high, but had no doubt about it. Having played a lot of off-season basketball with he and Joe, I knew that both those guys could go.
Well, obviously with that game, you guys go on to win the Super Bowl, and you're off to the races, and it's one of the great dynasty periods in the history of the NFL. What's the most important lesson you learned about chasing success from Bill Walsh?
You know, it's probably as high as 81 was, as great as being 16-3 was, winning our first Super Bowl. It was how fleeting and temporary success is. And, you know, the fact that everybody wants to pat you on the back, everybody wants to see your ring, everybody wants to relive those great moments, but you can't afford, if you're still playing the game, you can't afford to do any of that stuff. You've got to put all that in, and it's a cliche during the season about, you know, next game being in next mode and those type of comments you hear all the time. But even at the end of the season, you've got to take what that year was and you had to put it away. And that took a couple years to really learn it, because that next year we were terrible. We had more fun than allowable by law, and a lot of it not allowable by law. And we were 3-6 during that strike season in 82. 83, we got right to the NFC Championship game, almost got back to the Super Bowl, didn't get it done. That probably motivated a lot of us more than anything else. But that's when it really became, you know, crystal clear what you had to do, what it took to be successful, how focused you'd had to be, and how really elusive and temporary success is. Because in a team sport, you know, tomorrow is tomorrow, and nothing that happens today has anything to do with what has happened or what's going to happen or anything else. And if you can't forget that, and if you can't learn from that, you're going to have a hard time in team sports.
And in life.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you guys had some really crushing losses in the middle of this run. You had, you know, just one that was just gut-wrenching to the Giants. When you have a loss like that, after you've gotten keyed up and it's at the end of the season, how does that make you feel?
Kind of empty. It's Yeah, I mean, we had a few playoff losses. Two to the Giants that were pretty bad. One to the Vikings in the divisional round in 87, which was a huge upset because we were the best team in the league. We had no business losing that game. It's funny how you remember those terrible losses or those gut-wrenching losses almost as much as you remember the Super Bowls because of the jolting nature of those losses. Because, you know, there's not always another game. And when you're playing well and things are going great, you always assume there's going to be another game. And when that just sort of stops and it ends, it's, you know, it's 0-60 into a brick wall.
And yet that could be a great motivator, though, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Like I said, that after the 83 season, losing to the Redskins at RFK in the NFC Championship game, for whatever reason, you know, penalties or whatnot, Mosley kicked the field goal, we lost the game, and they went on to lose to the Raiders in the Super Bowl.
And you had a great comeback in that game against the Redskins that fell short. So that kind of make it even worse, right?
Yeah, because it was, you know, that was kind of our calling card. Every time you got down, you know, we got down against New Orleans in 80, we were down by 28 points, and we came back and beat them. Down 28 at halftime, 35-7, and came back and beat them 38-35. So every time we got down after that, you just kind of looked back and you went, that's not so bad. What, 4 minutes left and two touchdowns? We can do that. And often we did. So when they kind of flipped the script on us, that got a lot of people's attention. And that set up the year for, you know, the best team I ever played on was that 84 team.
You're listening to American Achievers. Stay tuned for more conversation. You guys had the perception, because the West Coast offense was so innovative, that being more of a finesse offense than a smash mouth offensive line. Does that bother you?
I always thought that perception only showed your ignorance about what we were doing, much more than it being an insult or anything else. We ran a lot. We pulled a lot. We trapped. We did a lot of different stuff for those times. And, you know, the perception was that it was, you know, a finesse style offense. I think if you look at where we ranked in the NFL through that 81-88 window, rushing the ball, we were rarely out of the top five and never out of the top 10. We always ran the ball and ran it effectively and had at least 1,000 yard rusher. So it's you choose to remember, I guess, and quantify things. But, you know, that was part of also, and we still see it now in college football, NFL, even a lot of our professional sports. You know, the West Coast kind of disappears off the radar for a lot of people because the games happen at night and they happen late at night. And there's just not that much attention. And at the same time, we were winning and doing well. You know, the NFC East was, you know, starting to sort of rear its ugly head with the Giants and the Redskins and the Eagles and the Cowboys and all that. And that was a smash mouth division. Well, you know, that's fine. There's a lot of ways to knock down a tree, and they're not all butting your head up against it.
What did you have to go through mentally to play a game?
Well, like I said, there wasn't a real short list of stuff we were asked to do. You know, there were some teams where you were going to drive block or you were going to pass block, and that was it. You know, we had to pull and trap, we had to pull on sweeps, we had screens, we had all sorts of different things that, you know, sort of our toolkit had to be a little bit more expansive than a lot of other teams. And that was, you know, it took a lot of pride in that. Now, not many defenses and defensive coaches and defensive players much appreciated some of the stuff we did. And much of it got was made illegal eventually. But that was fine. That was the whole idea. I mean, that's part of what you did in the offseason was you looked at what your year had been. You looked at some of the things you tried to do. And you studied the rule book. And you studied what you could and couldn't do. I mean, when I first came in the league, you had to hold your hands on your chest with your elbows up to pass block. You couldn't extend your arms into the defender. So rules changed and you adapt.
But did you have to get mean to go out and play?
I had that in me, so I didn't have to much worry about it. I had plenty of that. I'm not by nature a real, you know, uber aggressive, kind of nasty, but football gave me that outlet.
So you felt like you needed an outlet to get rid of your aggression, let's say.
Yeah. Well, it was a good place to get rid of it. Beat the heck out of the other alternatives, or you'd always end up with a guy with a star on his chest and looking to put you to the back seat of his car.
Well,
being tough and being physical, that was kind of a given in the NFL. You had to be able to do that.
And, you know, you're a big guy, but, you know, you played against some guys who were bigger than you. I mean, how did it feel to go up against a guy like a Too Tall Jones who, was a dominant player and huge and you know, he wants it as much as you do. I mean, what do you do when you're lining up on the line of scrimmage and you gotta win or lose, you know?
Yeah. Well, one of the better players I ever played against was Dave Butts, who played for the Washington Redskins. And Dave is 6'5", 6'6". He was about 310, 315 at that point. And I was – my weight varied. My first year I was about 250, 255. I got steadily bigger as my career went. But I was always listed at the same weight. That's why I always get a big kick out of these football cards I get when I sign them. I look in the back and it says 6'3", 245 or 6'3", 255. We didn't change our weights because we just hoped people thought that's how big we were because they were usually 20 to 30 pounds off of what we really were.
The winning drive, Super Bowl 23, that's probably one of your defining moments, right? Guys are playing Cincinnati. You're on the 8-yard line. You got to score to win the football game. You're already one of the great dynasties, but this is going to help you take that next leap. Put me on the field for that. And a story involving a young lineman named Harris Barton. What do you remember about that?
Yeah. I mean, we're basically huddling on the goal line or maybe even in the end zone. We're backed up. Everybody's uptight. Joe comes in the huddle and he read that kind of mood. And he was staring past me, past Guy McIntyre, right past Harris. And everyone's kind of, what are you looking at? And we kind of looked over there and Joe looks at Harris and goes, hey, H, is that John Candy? And we all look back over there again and go, hey, yeah, it is. He goes, how cool is that? All right, come on, let's go. And we, you know, go into what's going to happen on the
This drive is the most pressure-packed situation in professional football.
But, yeah, that was typical. We needed a field goal to tie and a touchdown to win and only 92 yards to go.
What did that – I guess you could say you could almost take that drive as a microcosm of that entire era. What did that say about that 49ers football team?
Well, it was definitely a microcosm of overcoming adversity that team had gone through because we had had at one point what looked to be a pretty average to bad year coming. We were 6-5. We had just lost to Arizona and the Raiders, and we needed to basically win out to get into the playoffs. And not only did we manage to get into the playoffs, we managed to win a Super Bowl. But that's very much, that was just a continuation of one more thing probably a lot of people didn't think we could do.
And how sweet was that that night?
It was great. I mean, that was my last game. Turned out to be that was Bill's last game. It was just the perfect way to go out. You know, I'd always been a fan of sports, like I said earlier, but specifically baseball, that I had always read. And you don't see them very often now, especially. I mean, they're probably cartoons or comic books now, but there were these books that were all about these famous athletes, whether it was Jackie Robinson or Frank Robinson or Babe Ruth or Lou Gehrig or whoever. I read that stuff like crazy. And, you know, I wanted to have one of those storybook ways to go out. I was lucky, due to the guys around me, I was able to do that.
Was it tough to make that decision?
Yeah, it was. You know, I had started a company, a promotions and marketing company, an advertising agency, about 3 years before I retired. So I was working full, you know, year round at that point. And I was doing pretty good off of that. And based on that sort of success, I decided maybe it was time for me to go away from the game, try to see if I could go into TV and, you know, explore that avenue. Little did I know that it would be like another career, but.
When you lost that outlet for your aggression, did you find anything to replace that aspect?
Not, you know, outside of working out, you know, I think that's something you can still do, which is kind of hitting things that can't hit back. But no, you know, I don't remember. The only time I really physically and mentally remember an issue of not playing football was for the first 10 or 12 years after I retired. Every July to August, you know, where that normally you'd be going to the training camp and you'd be going through those dog days, and that was physical, that was contact, that was all that aggression and all those outlets and everything else you're talking about. And you had nothing to do, but your body was used to having that as an outlet for a lot of years. So it took, you know, at least a dozen to 15 years before that feeling went away.
When you were still in San Francisco, you watched Montana have to defend his job from Steve Young and then ultimately lose it. What did you learn from watching that competition?
How much loyalty there was in football. You know, they drafted Steve in 87. And by that time, Joe had already won us two Super Bowls, was winning us still at a very high level. Getting Steve and sort of holding Steve over his head was a genius move by Bill. It made Joe better. It made Steve get better, and it made the team better. But, you know, it was definitely an uncomfortable kind of deal. Well, I know for me, I was Steve Young's roommate on the road and in a training camp. So Steve's very confident. Steve was positive he should be the starter. He was positive about how good he could be, you know, and it was something you didn't see very often. At least I didn't think you saw very often in the world of sports. And I know since then you haven't seen that happen very, very often to a lot of teams. I think teams intentionally go out of their way not to create that kind of tension and acrimony, but I think that tension and acrimony sent a very important message. And that was, you know what? If Bill could mess with him, he could mess with Joe. He could mess with our best guy. He could mess with anybody.
And it also kind of reflected, you know, the fact that, you know, competition is part of life. It makes you better. And ultimately, there's a cycle of life there. The next guy, he's going to be younger and stronger. And it happens in all sorts of businesses.
Oh, yeah, it does. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, it does. it reinforced, you know, to a large degree, that sort of feel, because you had to stay on your game. You had to stay. And it's really true now still, especially in the NFL, because it really is. Like Jerry Glanville said in that one NFL Films clip, you know, not for long, the NFL. If you don't keep improving and you don't do all those things and you don't just dedicate yourself in the off season, it will be not for long.
What's the one thing that you wish that the ordinary person out there in some other field could learn from the experience, the competition of playing in the National Football League?
I think that sort of common respect for the other guy, for the other teams, was something that, you know, I took away in general, especially when I started to do TV. You know, when I was doing TV, I kind of assumed everyone had always done things a specific way because that's the way we did them in San Francisco. I would learn very, very quickly that was not true. But, you know, that whole one thing in common, you're all players, you all have that, the whole experience, the whole laundry list of experiences in common. You know, that's something that, you know, I think a lot of players come away from the game feeling that way.
You've had a really good, you know, career in TV and radio. What's been the toughest, what was the toughest part of that transition?
Well, I guess the hardest part of it was kind of accepting, and you can work, you can watch tape, you can rehearse lines, you can do all kinds of different things. TV and being an analyst and being on TV is something you can either do or you can't do. You can learn to do it well, but that's as good as you can learn to do it. If you weren't meant to be able to do it, you will never be great. You will never be really, really good. And that's something that, much like playing, you know, when you're early in your career, you're always worried about the guys coming behind you. You're always worried about the guys getting drafted behind you. And when you're in TV, you're always worried about the guys retiring. Well, you know, after a handful of years, you start looking around and you accept that, you know, maybe you do have a pretty significant skill level. And that's something, like I said, you can either can or can't do. And there's a lot longer list of guys that have tried it and failed than the guys that have tried it and done it well.
And what skills did you have to perfect to be successful in that business?
I believe specifically you have to be able to see things happen. And that sounds rather innocuous, but when you watch tape, things jump out at you. A receiver making a block, a lineman pulling and doing something, a tight end maybe running a route where a safety slips and you see the guy pop open. That's one of the things that is invaluable as an analyst. You've got to be able, you can't see everything, but almost guaranteed something's going to jump at you. And then you got to be able to talk about it. Then you got to be able to describe it in ways that the people at home can relate to it. And at times that can be the biggest challenge. And, you know, sometimes you go a little bit off the beaten path. You better be able to reel yourself in and get your point back somewhere near that beaten path again.
All those years in television and in radio, is there anything that makes it tough for you to still be close to the game but not out there hitting somebody?
Not anymore. Not anymore. Like I said, that probably lasted about 15, 20 years. And I'm lucky enough to have been doing this now for, you know, 33 years. So, no, it's maybe sometimes on a game day, you get that kind of edge to you. But, nah.
How does that feel? Nah. How does that feel?
That edge?
Yeah, how's that feel?
I know when I'm grumpy. I'm very, very aware, and so are the people around me when I'm not in a good mood. And that's usually born out of you know, being hyper focused, because that's usually that's where a lot of that's born out of when you're playing.
But the preparation that you've done in TV and radio, obviously there's a connective tissue between the kind of preparation that you did, you know, as a player. So is there something similar in the way that you mentally kind of get ready?
I think the way you study little things, you know, like false steps by linebackers and alignment by defensive linemen and depth levels by defensive backs. You see that on tape and you see that live. And that, when you learn to sort of perform and learn doing things like that, you can't help be focused. You got to be hyper focused when what you're looking at is for that little stuff. You know, when you're an interior offensive lineman, it's not easy to read defenses. It's not easy to read coverages, but you got to be able to read those feet, know where those players are, and know what that alignment means.
You were inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame in 2010. What did that moment mean to you?
Oh, it meant a lot. I mean, it's a validation for you and, you know, my parents and my teammates and my coaches and everybody else that I was around. I had no idea what an extensive process that was until after I was already in. And then I got told of, you know, the different screening committees and everything else and the way it goes on. And when you think about it, how many millions and millions and millions of people have played college football and how few there are that are at that College Football Hall of Fame level. I was extremely proud. It was something I got to share with my family, got to share it with my mom, who was still around at that point. So it's pretty special.
What do you think your story illustrates about the American dream?
Just how, you know, nobody writes your story for you. And I think part of my story was highly unlikely, you know, starting with, you know, where I was born, sort of the environment I grew up in, not being a football guy until I had played for quite a few years where I actually wanted to keep playing. You know, I have no delusions. I was extremely lucky in a lot of things, and the timing was just about perfect. But I also have no delusions in the fact that, you know, I worked my ass off. I worked really, really hard when I decided to take my profession as a craft and hone the skills. And you know, I can tell you, it wasn't like that in high school. It wasn't like that in college. And it wasn't like that until probably after my first or second year in the pros, where I started lifting weights and doing the amount of preparation and whatnot in the off seasons. So, you know, there's various ways to get your validation, I guess. Being on the teams I was on, I thought validated a lot of what I did. And, you know, I can let the rest sort of settle where it settles.
If you could go back and spend a few minutes with your dad, what would you tell him?
Well, I'd start out just like everybody else that's lost a parent. I tell him how much I loved him. I tell him that I did always love him, but he made it incredibly hard. I don't know. I just would probably profusely thank him for what he went through and sort of what he had to do to make my life possible.
Thanks to Lane McGivney and all the good folks at Boutwell Studios for all the TLC required to bring this podcast to life. And audio engineers Joe Beeman and Jonathan W. Hickman. Remember, everyone has a special talent. You just need to identify it, cultivate it, and be willing to pay the price. You too can become an American Achiever.